Hello, I'm Eric Huang, and you're listening to Saint Podcast, a podcast about the always fascinating and often controversial lives of the saints. Saint Podcast is a history and culture podcast that traces the origins of the morality tales of the saints, or hagiographies, and how they continue to impact our lives today. This debut series of Saint Podcast is dedicated to martyrs, saints who died as a result of their beliefs. Over the next 10 episodes, we'll hear about martyred saints ranging from a queen who bested the brightest minds of the Roman Empire, a saint who was swallowed alive by a dragon, twin brothers who were both doctors, a gay icon, and many more. And since this is the debut episode of Saint Podcast, it seems appropriate to kick it all off with the story of St. Stephen, the proto-martyr, the first martyr recognized by many Christian churches. The story of St. Stephen comes from the Acts of the Apostles, a book from the New Testament, the book in the Bible about the life and death of Jesus Christ. St. Stephen is unusual because his story has a biblical source. The vast majority of saints are extra-biblical. They were born hundreds of years after the time covered in the stories in the Bible. They weren't alive in the first century and weren't contemporaries of Christ the way St. Stephen, Mary Magdalene, and the 12 apostles were. According to the Bible, Stephen was born around the year 5 BCE and was a contemporary of Jesus Christ. He was a subject of the Roman Empire and lived and died in Jerusalem, which was then in the Roman province of Judea. Stephen was a Hellenistic Jew, a Jew of Greek descent who spoke Greek, a language spoken widely in the Eastern Roman Empire. Very little of Stephen's early life is known. When we first meet him in the Acts of the Apostles, he's working as a deacon. Deacons were the precursors to today's priests, one of the early administrators of the church. These men were selected by the 12 apostles, who were Jesus' most devoted followers, to help spread the philosophy of this new Jewish sect throughout the Roman Empire. Early Christians considered themselves a reform movement within the larger Jewish community. Christians didn't really identify themselves as a separate religion just yet. Stephen's work primarily involved the doling out of alms, or the distribution of food and money, to the widows of Hellenistic Jews, Greek-speaking Jews like Stephen. Stephen was selected by the apostles for three reasons. One, he was a recent convert to this new Christian sect of Judaism. Two, he was a Jew of Greek origin. The Greek Jews in Jerusalem had lodged complaints to the apostles that Greek widows were being neglected. Stephen, with his Greek heritage, was a perfect candidate to be one of the first seven deacons. Thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, Stephen was selected because of his skills as an orator. His speeches inspired many to follow this new sect and buy into the new philosophies of the Christians. Stephen's popularity soon spread beyond the Hellenistic Jewish community, and according to the Bible, he performed many miracles during this time, though the details of the miracles aren't recorded. Stephen's growing reputation worried members of several important synagogues in Jerusalem. Stephen was challenging the status quo and local government. In particular was Stephen's bitter opposition to the Temple of Jerusalem, the holy center of the Jewish people and the heart of both religious and secular power. Stephen likened the existence of the temple to idolatry, quoting scripture that the Most High does not dwell in houses made with hands. In Stephen's point of view, and in the point of view of many early Christians, the religious heart of the community should not be an expensive, beautiful, man-made building like the temple. And of course, the early Christians' belief that Jesus was the long-awaited Messiah predicted by Jewish scripture was something that contradicted mainstream Judaism. Despite authorities' warnings, Stephen refused to back down. Soon, he attracted powerful opposition in the form of a group of Hellenistic Jews called the Synagogue of the Libertines. Historians are divided about who the Libertines actually were. Their name suggests that they may have been an organization of freed slaves, liberated from their servitude, and the synagogues that made up the Libertines may have been spread throughout the Roman Empire in Asia Minor, Northeast Africa, and also Italy. Whoever they were, the members of the Synagogue of the Libertines were bitterly opposed to Stephen's teachings and had him arrested on charges of blaspheming against Moses and God. Stephen was locked away to await judgment. On the date of Stephen's trial, he stood before the Sanhedrin. This was a tribunal of elders that presided over religious and judicial matters. Every Jewish community had one, and it was recognized by the Roman Empire, allowing a fair amount of freedom to the Sanhedrin to rule over local matters. The Great Sanhedrin in Jerusalem was the supreme religious body of the land. Such was Stephen's unshakable faith in this new sect that instead of cowering before the Sanhedrin, he debated doctrine with them. He insisted that God's teachings could be accessed by anyone, wherever and whomever they may be, not just Jews in Judea. Quoting from Jewish scriptures to support his ideas, Stephen denounced his accusers as hypocrites. Here is verse 52 from chapter 7 of the Acts of the Apostles, which quotes Stephen in court. Can you name a single prophet your ancestors never prosecuted? They killed those who foretold the coming of the upright one, and now you have become his betrayers, his murderers. Stephen essentially accused everyone against him of being complicit in the murders of ancient prophets and holy men, and compared the recent death of Jesus to the deaths of these revered figures. The members of the council were outraged, and according to the Bible, they, quote, ground their teeth at him. At this moment, St. Stephen looked up and saw God with Jesus at his side and described this vision to the court. This was the last straw. The Sanhedrin couldn't believe the blasphemy coming out of Stephen's mouth. He challenged their authority, challenged the authority of the Temple of Jerusalem itself, and he dared to suggest that this recently executed criminal named Jesus Christ sat at the right hand of God. The crowd that had gathered to watch the proceedings was so incensed they began to call for the gravest sentence, a public stoning. Suddenly, in a mad rush, Stephen was pulled outside. As the judges of the Sanhedrin joined the murderous mob, each removed their official garments and left them with a man named Saul. Saul was also a Hellenistic Jew. He was a staunchly anti-Christian official who persecuted Christians. We know him better by his Latin name, Paul, St. Paul, one of the most important early followers of Jesus who helped spread Christianity throughout the Roman world. Whilst traveling to Damascus years later, a blinding flash of light struck Paul off his horse. A voice spoke to him, which made Paul, Saul, convert to Christianity. But this is a story for another St. Podcast episode. Stephen was now outside. Members of the Sanhedrin and onlookers began picking up rocks and threw them as hard as they could. As the first stones hit Stephen, he gazed heavenward and cried out that he could see Jesus and prayed for forgiveness for his killers. And so Stephen, aged about 30 years old, bled to death as rocks struck his head and body. Stephen's story is not dissimilar to Christ's story in that they were both accused of holding heretical ideas at odds with the teachings of mainstream Judaism. Both performed wonders and miracles that won them followers, and both were ultimately tried and executed by legal authorities, threatened by the increasing popularity of the accused. In one medieval legend, first recorded several hundred years after the biblical account, Stephen's story is even closer to that of Christ's. In this version, Sanhedrin officials first tried to crucify Stephen. Angels rushed to Stephen's aid, thwarting the Sanhedrin's plans. And so Stephen is taken down from the cross, taken outside, and then stoned to death. Another legend from the 10th century, whose origin is unclear and is also not a biblical account, fills in the story of St. Stephen's childhood. When Stephen was born, the devil kidnapped him, replacing the baby Stephen with a changeling, a demon or fairy creature disguised as a child. The real Stephen was then banished to a faraway land. Unbeknownst to the devil, however, a white doe finds and adopts Stephen. She nurses him until he's discovered by a bishop named Julian. Bishop Julian returns Stephen to Jerusalem, then confronts the changeling to burn it to death on a pyre. Stephen's biblical story was expanded quite a bit in the Middle Ages. After he's returned home by Bishop Julian, another legend claims that Stephen turned wine into blood at his parents' home, proof of the boy's saintly nature and his close connection with Christ. A biblical story tells of how Christ transformed water into wine at a wedding when the wine ran out, and wine in Catholic Mass is transformed into the blood of Christ during the Eucharistic rite when the priest consecrates or blesses the wine. The wine, or blood, is a symbol of Christ's suffering and death on earth that allowed the faithful to go to heaven after death. That Stephen turns wine into blood mirrors this mystical rite. The peoples of Scandinavia and Britain had a St. Stephen legend that connects him directly with the birth of Christ, and also the story of the three kings. In the Bible, the three kings were originally three astrologers. According to the Gospel of Matthew, these astrologers traveled from faraway kingdoms in the east, following a supernaturally brilliant star to Jerusalem, where they were granted an audience with King Herod. Once in the king's courtroom, they asked him, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and have come to worship him." Herod is, of course, shocked by the news of a potential usurper to his throne, born right under his nose. His own astrologers confirmed that this newly born king of the Jews is the Messiah predicted by Jewish scripture, and that the baby and his family are still in Bethlehem. The baby in the prophecy is, of course, a newborn Jesus Christ, whose family has found shelter in a manger in Bethlehem. Determined, nevertheless, to thwart the prophecies, Herod then orders the murder of the innocents. Every male child aged 2 and under is to be executed in order to prevent the prophesied king from ever growing up. Unfortunately for King Herod, heavenly agents warn Jesus and his family of the danger to come, and they escape to Egypt as refugees. Herod is outraged and orders his men to arrest Stephen and stone him to death. Afterwards, Herod gives the order to murder all male children aged 2 and under. This St. Stephen version of the story persists today as a traditional English Christmas carol still sung in parts of the UK. Incidentally, the majority of biblical scholars label the massacre of the innocents as a legend. No historical evidence has ever been found for the event. The Catholic Church and most other Christian denominations also don't recognize any of these extra-biblical legends about St. Stephen from the Middle Ages. Nevertheless, they persist even today and have been the subject of numerous works of art. As we've heard, the core story of St. Stephen comes from the Bible. Other legends from Scandinavia and Northern Britain fill in the gaps of Stephen's life. We now turn to yet another source to hear about what happened after Stephen's death. This source is the Golden Legend, a 13th century collection of hagiographies written by Jacobus de Voragine, the Archbishop of Genoa. It's a massive compendium of saint stories passed on orally and not written down until now. According to the Golden Legend, after Stephen was killed, his body was taken away by a man named Gamaliel, a teacher of Saul Paul mentioned earlier. Again, none of the stories in the Golden Legend appear in the Bible. The biblical account of Stephen ends with his death. The Golden Legend tells us that Gamaliel finds Stephen's corpse and gives it a proper burial. Fast forward now 350 years to the year 415. A priest named Lucian has a dream. Gamaliel comes to him in the dream and tells Lucian where he buried St. Stephen's body. Gamaliel then instructs Lucian to tell the bishop of Jerusalem to exhume the body, along with his own body and the bodies of some other saints also buried in the same tomb. The corpses are to be interred at a church in Jerusalem where they can be venerated. When he wakes up, Lucian panics, not sure if the dream was a message from God or the work of the devil. So Lucian prays and fasts for 2 weeks, asking God to repeat the vision if it's truly a message from heaven. The vision does repeat, but Lucian freaks out again. Gamaliel then appears to Lucian a third and final time. Lucian is finally convinced that the dreams are divine and travels to Jerusalem. He finds the bishop and tells him about the dream. Following Gamaliel's orders, the bishop has the bodies of St. Stephen, Nicodemus, Abibon, and Gamaliel himself exhumed. As the coffins are opened, a sweet fragrance fills the chamber. All who were witness to the event, about 100 people, were instantly cured of all ailments. These two miracles confirm to all present that the corpses are indeed the bodies of the saints in question. Stephen's body was deposited in the Church of Sion, one of the oldest Christian churches in Jerusalem. There are many churches devoted to St. Stephen all around the world, notably a Greek Orthodox church in Jerusalem built on the alleged spot of Stephen's martyrdom near the Damascus Gate. There's also the Basilica of St. Lawrence in Rome, which contains St. Stephen's relics under the main altar. Relics are the remains of a saint, like body parts and bones, and also items associated with the saint, like articles of clothing. A marble slab beneath the choir floor at this church is said to be the very stone where Stephen was placed after his execution. From the Roman era onwards, a church had to have relics, body parts of saints or objects associated with them, in order to attract pilgrims and worshippers. According to the faithful, relics have curative powers. Praying to them or touching them can bring about miracles of all kinds. These sacred items give a legitimacy to the church and a reason for people to visit and pray for a miracle. And once travelers have finished their prayers, they'd need a place to stay, food to eat, even souvenirs to buy for friends, family, themselves. It was, and still is, a very big business. The reputations and economies of many cities in Europe and the wider Mediterranean still depend on religious tourism brought about by the relics housed in local churches. St. Stephen is indirectly responsible for the obsession with relics. Relics of St. Stephen being the first martyr were highly sought after, and his body has been moved or translated multiple times between various churches and cities and states. There are many swashbuckling stories about saints' bodies and body parts that were split up and stolen, divided between empires through the centuries, that are more like the plots of spy novels than a simple story of the life of a saint. And there was a great trade in fraudulent relics, body parts dug up from anonymous graves, presented as the genuine legs of St. Roch or the eyes of St. Lucy to religious and secular officials desperate to obtain a relic to make their church and locale relevant and thus guarantee their financial security. Augustine of Hippo was a big opponent to this relic frenzy. He was a philosopher and theologian from Roman North Africa who lived in the 4th and 5th centuries. He's one of the most influential people of his time and hugely impacted Western philosophy, as well as shaping the philosophy and practice of modern Christianity. Augustine was also canonized or made a saint after his death. We could devote an entire saint podcast series just to Saint Augustine. Augustine argued that the point of Christ dying on the cross was so that people didn't need a go-between like a finger bone or shirt of a saint to talk to God. Also, the most desired relics were often housed in beautifully designed vessels of precious metals and gemstones. In Augustine's opinion, praying to these bejeweled items was just like praying to golden idols or statues of Zeus and Venus, a heretical rite many Romans and other so-called pagans still practice widely. Augustine also saw the commercial reasons behind the acquisition of relics. Parishes that had the most popular relics became extremely wealthy, as did the local nobility and clergy. Augustine's view changed, however, and this was because of St. Stephen. Parts of St. Stephen's body were translated to North Africa in modern-day Algeria, where St. Augustine lived. Miracles started happening almost immediately. These included the restoration of sight, the curing of gout, the dispelling of a mother's curse from her children who had wandered the Mediterranean looking for relief, and the resurrection of at least four people, a boy who had died in an accident with an ox, a baby, a nun, and a priest. All this happened when the afflicted touched St. Stephen's relics, or in the case of the nun, when her habit, which had touched the relics, touched her dead body. St. Augustine heard of these miracles and eventually witnessed one himself in his hometown of Hippo. A man who had been suffering from a fistula was due to be operated on. The day before the operation, the man visited a church where St. Stephen's relics were kept. When surgeons began the operation, they were stunned. He had been cured. Augustine was now a proponent of relics and compiled first-hand accounts of miracles caused by St. Stephen's relics. He also included a discussion of relics in his theological treatise, City of God, which is one of the most influential books in the history of Christianity. Augustine sanctioned the practice of worshiping relics, and so the massing of relics continued for centuries, though not without controversy. And this obsession with relics is one of the many criticisms lobbed at the church in Rome, which led to the Protestant Reformation and the modern face of Christianity today. If not for the miracles performed by St. Stephen's relics, the world might be a very different place. All saints are patrons of something. Stephen's patronage includes masons, bricklayers, horses, Serbia, casket makers, headaches, and Kigali, the capital of Rwanda. Saints are also traditionally given attributes, symbols that illustrate their lives and deeds and appear in artistic depictions of the saint. In Stephen's case, these include stones, miniature churches, and censers, which are ornate containers for incense. Stephen's often pictured wearing a dalmatic garment, religious garb from the Eastern or Orthodox Church, a nod to Stephen's Greek heritage. He also often carries the Gospels in art. Most common in paintings and sculpture are rocks, the rocks that killed him. They often sit on his head or on the Bible he holds, looking like bread rolls or Princess Leia's hair. My favorite artworks are two paintings. One is a 17th century triptych by Peter Paul Rubens at the National Gallery in London, and the second one, a painting by Giovanni Domenico Tiepolo at the Alte Pinakothek in Munich. This piece in Munich is particularly brutal, with onlookers from the Sanhedrin trial transformed into burly wild men holding gigantic rocks the size of microwaves over their heads, about to smash Stephen to bits. St. Stephen is mentioned in the song Good King Wenceslas, the traditional Christmas carol sung on St. Stephen's Day or Boxing Day, the day after Christmas. This is the day when Catholics and other Christian denominations celebrate the saint. The Eastern Orthodox Church celebrates St. Stephen's Day on the 27th. Good King Wenceslas is about the historic Bohemian king and saint from the 10th century who goes out on St. Stephen's Day to give alms to the poor. St. Stephen's Day is still celebrated in many parts of Europe and linked to charity, and it's still a public holiday in many parts of the world. In parts of Ireland, St. Stephen's Day is also known as Wren's Day, a festival with pagan roots. The wren is thought to be a treacherous bird in Christian, Norse, and Celtic legends. They are said to have betrayed the Irish in wars against the Vikings. They are associated with an enchantress from Celtic legends from the Isle of Man, and it was a wren that won a contest Christ held to find the king of the birds. The wren won by cheating. The little bird hitchhiked on the back of an eagle and flew up only when the eagle tired so that he flew the highest to win the contest. An Irish legend also blames the wren for St. Stephen's death. In this version of the biblical story, St. Stephen initially escapes his Sanhedrin attackers, but a wren betrays his hiding place, which results in Stephen's death by stoning. These legends help to explain the origins of the Wren's Day festivals, in which the little birds were hunted, then tied, often alive, to a pole or simply kept in a net. Wren boys then carried the captured and bound wrens and paraded through town asking for money in exchange for a feather plucked from the live birds. Different factions would play fight for the money, and traditional revelers dressed in body-length grass outfits and also as old women. The money raised was used for a party called the Wren Dance, as well as for local charitable causes. The festival has Celtic and Norse roots and is celebrated in the British Isles and also in Spain and France. No wrens are hurt in modern Wren's Day festivals. The living birds have been replaced by toy birds. Mummers' Day and the associated parade are also celebrated on the 26th of December, St. Stephen's Day. The celebration was originally a Celtic winter solstice event, also known as Darkling Day, in reference to the ever-present darkness on the winter solstice, the shortest day of the year. Participants in the parade wore masks and blackened their faces to acknowledge the darkest day, although modern blackface celebrations have met with much controversy. Both Wren's Day and Mummers' Day celebrations predate Christianity and St. Stephen. Both became associated with this Christian saint day as a religion spread out of the Roman provinces of Judea to the Middle East, North Africa, then Europe. As the new religion spread, Christian stories and symbols syncretized with native beliefs, reshaping ancient stories with Christian themes. And so Wren's Day and Mummers' Day, which were held on St. Stephen's Day, eventually became one and the same. St. Stephen in Spanish is Santo Esteban. In French, it's Saint-Étienne. So the French town, French football club, and the English band are all named after St. Stephen. St. Stephen the proto-martyr was the first person recognized by the Christian church who died because of a Christian identity separate from his Jewish contemporaries. His story in the Bible marks the moment when a mystical Jewish sect broke from its roots to eventually become the official religion of the Roman Empire, then one of the largest religions of the world. It's because of miracles attributed to St. Stephen's relics that swayed Augustine of Hippo to double down on worshiping relics, changing the face of Christianity forever. And Stephen lives on today in familiar Christmas carols, and also on the day after Christmas, when so many people around the world get one more day off. Thank you so much for listening to the first episode of St. Podcast, all about St. Stephen, the proto-martyr. I'd love to hear from you. If you have any comments, questions, suggestions for future episodes, please email saintpodcast@gmail.com, and that's saint spelled out, S-A-I-N-T. The next Saint Podcast episode in this martyr series is about one of the most popular saints. He's the patron saint of soldiers, athletes, law enforcement, and archers. He's also a gay icon. Tune in for the story of Saint Sebastian.